This is Issues and Ideas. I'm Brian Lanzone. Today on the program, travel correspondent Tom Wilmer takes us to Arkansas to visit two venues that promote and preserve Southern culture. Also, Stephen DeLuque talks with former Central Coast resident Mark Beck, who currently has a show of his paintings at the San Luis Obispo Museum of Art. But first, let's take a look into the business of chocolate.
I'm Marisa Waddell with you on Issues and Ideas. Chocolate is one of the most popular dessert items in the world. U.S. consumers eat nearly half the world's supply of chocolate. Chocolate is big business, but cocoa farmers suffer disproportionately from the inequities in the world cocoa trade. My guest today is a man whose mission is to assist cocoa farmers, particularly in Africa, and decolonize chocolate, as he calls it. Tom Newhouse is founder and president of Project Hope and Fairness, professor of food science at Cal Poly, and recognized expert on fair trade chocolate. He's the owner of Mama Ganache Artisan Chocolates, which is one of the first fair trade chocolatiers in the U.S. He's joined by a couple of guys, Garrett Morris and Brandon Morris. Garrett is Tom's teaching assistant and a student. And Garrett and Brandon are bicycling across the U.S. to raise consciousness about child labor and to raise money so that students can attend sessions about cocoa farming and chocolate manufacturing at the Cocoa Study Center in Ekona, Cameroon. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Tom, let's start by having you give us a short background about Project Hope and Fairness and tell us why you're focusing on the Ivory Coast.
I started in 2003 going to visit villages in Ghana, Cameroon, and Ivory Coast. And those are the three largest producers of cocoa in the world, amounting to over 70% of all the cocoa beans that are used in the world's chocolate. Ivory Coast alone produces 40 to 43% of the world's cocoa, Ghana 20%, and Cameroon 5%. And then there, in 2000, there was this concern about child labor in the industry. So I've been focusing on those three countries because they are so important and they use a lot of child labor.
Mm-hmm. And so what was your first effort and how did it grow?
My first effort was merely to visit a fair trade certified cooperative in Ghana. And then from there, in about 2005, I had met this young man at the castle on Cape Coast, and he and I became friends. And I asked him to set up a tour of five villages in Ghana that I could bring students to show them how cocoa is grown and what are some of the issues around sustainable growing of cocoa.
Mm-hmm. We'll learn a little bit more about Project Hope and Fairness as we continue our conversation here. But I wanted to ask Garrett, tell me your story. How did you get involved with Project Hope and Fairness? And why did you decide to bike across the United States?
So my freshman year at Cal Poly, I joined the Fair Trade Club, and Tom is our advisor. But through the Fair Trade Club, we did a fundraiser to send a student to West Africa with Tom. I was chosen to go with him. So I went to Ghana two summers ago with Project Hope and Fairness. So I've been very involved with it. I'm going to be the president of the Fair Trade Club next year. Mm-hmm. Then last fall, I was studying abroad in China, and I had a little too much caffeine one night, and I just couldn't go to sleep. And then I thought to me, it'd be fun to bike across the country. So I called my brother the next day, and he said he'd be willing to join me. So we started planning that, and then we thought it'd be a great idea to raise money for Project Hope and Fairness along the way.
Garrett, how long is it going to take you?
Our goal is the end of August. But we have to be there by September 5th because that's when our flight back is.
Okay. And I'm assuming you'll be speaking along the way since this is about bringing awareness.
Yeah, we're trying to get some other newspaper articles and talking to people.
We are raising awareness mainly through our website. We're just trying to bring awareness for Project Hope and Fairness. And our goal is to raise $50,000 to build this study center or to at least bring people to it.
Tell me about this study center, Tom.
Yes. Originally, I was hoping to do it in Ghana, but I went to Cameroon several years ago. I had met this guy on the web who seemed really intelligent and helpful. So I've told him I wanted to find a place where we could do a cocoa study center. Last summer, he set up a seminar. So a faculty member from Ball State University and I gave a seminar at the University of Buea, and then we visited a research center, which is just 20 minutes away from the university. It's three buildings that were built by the USAID that were abandoned and in perfectly good shape. We could use them anytime. So as far as a place to do it where we could visit villages, have a place for students to live, and consider some of the problems around sustainability, that's not a problem. What's the problem is getting students to go there. One way is to make it a lot less expensive because it costs $2,300 just to land in Douala, Cameroon, and then you have about $2,000 on the ground expenses for the week or 10 days. So that's about $4,300, so that's a lot of money.
So what will they be learning at such a study center?
So I'm going to start simply. We're going to go visit villages, spend time with village chiefs, learning about some of the problems that they have, talking about how to decolonialize chocolate, that is, how to get the more of the value of the chocolate to the local farmer rather than having all the chocolate just go to Europe and the United States. So how to make chocolate. I'm going to bring a small machine that will make small amounts, and then they can sell that. And the students can work on building a local economy, how to wrap chocolate, how to make chocolate, how to sell chocolate locally as a solution. Then there are many other ways of building on this, you know, permaculture, nutrition, food science. There's a lot of other issues, but start small, start simply with just focusing on sustainability in the cocoa value chain.
Mm-hmm. It's Issues and Ideas. I'm Marisa Waddell. My guests are Tom Newhouse, founder and president of Project Hope and Fairness, Garrett Morris, and Brandon Morris, who are bicycling across the U.S. to raise consciousness about child labor and to raise money so that students can attend sessions about cocoa farming and chocolate manufacturing at the Cocoa Study Center in Ekona, Cameroon. So, Garrett and Brandon, how are you going to raise the $50,000 that you plan to raise during your bike trip?
Yeah, so we have a website that we've put a PayPal on that people have been going to and donating, hopeonabike.webs.com.
I'd like to think the world works. If you put energy into something, you'll get it back. So we're just putting the word out there, and our effort and energy will hopefully manifest itself in people being able to go to Ghana and also result in the eventual $50,000 goal.
So, Tom, you just finished building a warehouse and installing a rice hulling machine in Depa on the Ivory Coast. Tell us about that project.
Women in the West, in West African countries, there's two things that they certainly do every day. One is hauling water every day of their lives. And the other thing is pounding rice because, surprise, surprise, there's low spots in the jungle and people have been growing rice there long before they were growing rice here in the United States. So they pound this rice every single day, and rice is one of the main staples in the West African diet. So if they didn't have to pound the rice, which looks great, I mean, it's great for tourism to watch somebody pound rice, but imagine having to do that 365 days a year. If you had a center where villages cooperated and everybody came to that center where then they can have the rice decorticated, that is, have the hull removed for them, that will save them a tremendous amount of time. And then I thought, while we build this warehouse that's connected to the electrical grid, have a little room where I can put my chocolate machine and I can show them how to make chocolate and maybe start this as a movement throughout Ivory Coast, showing people how to make chocolate in rice hulling centers.
So you're going to be installing this chocolate making machine, and that's to teach cocoa farmers how to make chocolate.
Correct.
That's the decolonization of chocolate that you're talking about. Tell us more about that.
Cocoa's been grown in West Africa since the late 19th century, and by the 1930s, West Africa accounted for 60% of all the cocoa grown in the world. And so they've been growing and fermenting and drying it for many years, but they never really did anything with it other than think of it as a way to buy malaria medication, send their kids to school, buy shoes, etc. It's just a cash crop. But they do appreciate chocolate, and when I bring it from Mama Ganache, they do appreciate the flavor. They really like it. And there are European companies that are making chocolate in Africa and selling it to Africans, but why can't they be making it in the village? It's not that hard. given a small machine, they can be making it themselves and selling it themselves.
Tell me about the fundraiser you have coming up, Tom. It's July 20th. And it's a dinner and auction at the Pear Valley Winery in Paso Robles.
Yeah, it's a wine and food pairing. There's going to be five different foods and five different wines. And the wines are from Pear Valley Winery. And the food is from Tom Dreos, who's got his own company and also is a well-known local chef.
And your keynote speaker is Kelsey Timmerman, the author.
That's right, yes. He came with me to Ivory Coast last summer. He spent a week with my mother, who's 89, and me, tromping through villages. And he actually sort of split off from us and worked for whole days on the farm, because his book, which is Where Are We Eating, he basically went to five different countries to find out how the different foods that we eat are grown. And that's what he did in Ivory Coast.
Tell me what's next on your agenda for Project Hope and Fairness after this fundraiser.
I'm planning to be in West Africa in September and bring the chocolate machine.
Why should the average U.S. citizen buy fair trade chocolate instead of just any old chocolate off the shelf?
I think for the same reason, why should the average citizen buy organic instead of non-organic? I mean, there's a certain amount of trust involved in the system. It's what we've got to, it does more than any other system, you know, because the system basically is set up around child labor. And it's a belief in the future that we can actually affect change, that by changing how we think and how we act, that we can actually have an effect on change across the world. And so I think, you know, buying chocolate that is produced by five-year-olds, if raising money for your school with a company that is buying slave-produced chocolate for your children to have football uniforms or to have musical instruments, I think there's something wrong with that. I think that it's much better if we are aware of what's going on.
And Garrett, tell me what the website is. If someone wants to track you during your bike trip, how does one do that?
So we're going to be having a Tumblr, which is hopeonabike.tumblr.com. And we're also going to be updating our Facebook, which is Hope on a Bike. And we also have a website, hopeonabike.webs.com, which is where you can find out more information about Project Hope and Fairness and our donation page.
Yeah, it's WEBS.com.
Yeah, webs.
Okay, great. And it's projecthopeandfairness.org for you.
That's correct. All one word.
Yeah, and our campaign's it's called Hope on a Bike. So hopeonabike.tumblr, hopeonabike.webs.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much. My guests have been Tom Newhouse, founder and president of Project Hope and Fairness, Garrett Morris and Brandon Morris, who are bicycling across the U.S. to raise consciousness about child labor and to raise money so that students can attend sessions about cocoa farming and chocolate manufacturing at the Cocoa Study Center in Ekona, Cameroon. I'm Marisa Waddell with you on Issues and Ideas.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
You are listening to KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. Still to come on Issues and Ideas, Ears on Art brings us a look at an exhibit currently showing at the San Luis Obispo Museum of Art. But up next, travel correspondent Tom Wilmer takes us to Arkansas for an exploration of Southern culture.
Jesus, hold me when my spirit starts to flee.
I recently traveled to Arkansas in search of distinctively Southern experiences. I quickly discovered that the South lives on in many ways that are touchingly unique and unlike anywhere else in America. And the locals often make a mission of not only showcasing but cherishing their distinctively Southern characteristics, from food and music to conversation. Every Tuesday night, Paula Morell and her husband Jason host another live episode of Tales from the South, situated in a nondescript storefront in the heart of Little Rock's Argenta Arts District. Locals as well as visitors from around the world take their seats in the standing room only Starving Artist Cafe for a dinner and a show. It's a combination of Southern musicians performing blues, bluegrass, and folk, along with storytelling and readings by distinctively Southern authors, actors, and performers, with accompanying cuisine that is also very much local and regional. I'm Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me as I visit with Paula Morell, followed by a conversation with Jason Morell, who's the chef at the Starving Artist Cafe.
All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. And I'm your host, Paula Morell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Really exciting to see the show grow. We started off as a really small show, and it's we've been on the air for 8 years now, and it's been really picking up speed these last 2 or 3 years, and it's a pet project of mine, something I just love doing, so it's been really cool to see it grow the way it has.
So it really is telling the stories by the Southerners.
Oh, yeah.
Give us kind of a word picture of your typical storyteller, how it goes, what they're sharing.
Well, the show is true stories told by the Southerners who live them, so it has to be their story. And we have different kinds of shows, but on a typical night, we'll have 3 different storytellers. The story has to be true, and it has to be their story. The connection to the South is actually the writer, not the story. Our stories have actually been set all over the world, but the writer has to be either originally from the South or living in the South now.
Well, you know, I'm a storyteller, and I always like to tell people like your husband one of my stories.
Mm-hmm.
I go, this is a true story. There is that huge license when we talk about true story.
Yes, truth is relative. And, you know, I teach writing workshops as well, and I tell people, you know, they say, well, people have asked me, you know, how do you know if the stories are true? And I tell people, you know, truth is your truth. And the story that you experienced, the event you experienced as a kid, let's say, your sister, I can guarantee you, has a different version of that story. And your mother or parent certainly has a different version.
Right.
So truth is relative. And we don't fact check. It's not a factual show. But it is, you know, something that people kind of have to understand about what truth is.
When you talk about stories from the South, does that mean Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Texas?
When I started the show, when I created the show, it was to name the show Tales from the South and not Tales from Arkansas. It just dawned on me as I was creating the show, if we were to expand, this is a really Southern way of doing things. This is how Southerners tell stories. And so we actually include all 16. And I've even had to redefine what the South is. Originally, I was calling it the Deep South, but then I discovered that some maps don't consider Arkansas the Deep South, which is mind-blowing to me. So I had to redefine what the South was. And so we use actually what's called the Confederate South, the slavery states. So there's 16 states in Tales from the South. And we've actually had storytellers from all 16 states now.
What does deep mean then?
I know. Yeah. If you're not, if this isn't the Deep South, I don't know what is, both culturally and on the map. But it's been so cool to have people come in and do the show from all the different states. It's been fun.
A little bit more about your show.
To me, it's when people ask me what it's like, I tell them it's kind of a cross between a house concert, a house party concert, and a literary reading. You know, it's kind of a merging of the two. We have live music, and we feature local musicians, and then we'll have the storytellers come on and tell their stories.
I was 8 years old with my head full of rollers when I followed the oldest May sister toward a machine in the back room of the May sister's beauty parlor. A machine that looked like a cross between the electric chair and a torture machine I'd seen in a Saturday movie serial, you know, where a half man, half monster captured victims for his mad scientist master to experiment on. It also looked a little bit like an octopus. But I'm telling you, it was a machine that took my breath away. After years of trying and failing to make my hair curly like Shirley Temple's, Mama had decided it was time for me to get a hot perm. Now understand, getting a hot perm 60 years ago involved roving your hair around big old heavy metal rollers and then taking some thingamabobs that looked like big iron clothespins hanging down on those electric wires, hooking them around the rollers, and turning on the current.
It includes dinner. Dinner is actually a very, very important part of the show because, you know, growing up, like what our storyteller said tonight, sitting around the table telling stories is just a huge part of what we did. And so for me, dinner is an integral part of it. We actually do shows in different on location at different places now. And I've tried them a couple of times, like in a theater setting or in a different mm-hmm. setting that didn't include dinner. It just doesn't feel right. So we're now requiring that wherever we go, it's part of the show. So, but yeah, it includes the music and the storytelling. And, you know, the funnest part for me at the end, when people are still sitting around, the people in the audience are still talking to each other and telling their own stories. That's so cool, because now they're even connecting even more, because storytelling is so incredibly important. And I think as a society and as a culture, we've gotten away from it in a lot of ways with our text and our short little snippets of information. And to connect with people on that level is incredibly important, and it just helps us all to be able to do that. So,
well, I think you hit it on the head with the house party angle, and that they're very much as a family, communal, friendly. And I think without, like you said, you're right, without that dinner element, it wouldn't be the same.
It doesn't feel right, yeah.
Paula, we're out of time. Before we go, how somebody would access you on the World Wide Web?
My name is Paula Morrell, and the name of the show is Tales from the South Radio Show. We have a website, talesfromthesouth.com. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher Smart Radio. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Little Rock, Arkansas. My journey to Little Rock, Arkansas would have been incomplete without visiting with Warwick Sabin, publisher of the renowned Oxford American Literary Magazine. Birthed in Mississippi, the publication is now firmly nestled in Little Rock, with an enviable history of attracting outstanding writers such as Eudora Welty, John Updike, William F. Buckley, and more. The Oxford American is right now raising the bar for print publications everywhere by the establishment of its South on Main venue for showcasing not only its great writers reading their works, but live musical performances, visual art presentations, and melding it all with cutting-edge Southern-style food and beverages and more. I'm Tom Wilmer. Join me for a chat with Warwick Sabin.
Oxford American Magazine started in Mississippi?
That's right, Oxford, Mississippi, in 1992. Yeah. And John Grisham was the first publisher.
A real illustrious, legendary history, and it's known to pretty much everybody in the literary world. It's a bell ringer.
That's right. It's a beloved magazine, and some of the best writers, Southern and otherwise, have been published in its pages, and it's won multiple national magazine awards and other high honors, and so we come in with a very strong literary reputation.
Today, it has transmuted, and it's under the auspices of a state university?
Well, we're actually affiliated with the University of Central Arkansas, but we do operate independently.
It's a nonprofit.
That's right. We're a 501c3 nonprofit.
So here you are in the middle, I mean, literally under construction in your new incarnation of the magazine. How are you evolving the magazine? Tell us about your vision. What is happening right now?
Sure. Well, it's very important to us to continue to put out the kind of unique content and perspective on the South that the Oxford American is known for, because we're really the only publication that documents the intellectual and cultural life of the South. And we feel like there are several ways to do that beyond just publishing the print magazine. And because Southern culture has so many multiple facets to it, for instance, you know, cuisine, music, literature, of course, but also film, art, photography, that these are things that we want to deliver to our readers in other ways. And so we've been doing a lot of events and programming over the last few years, and it occurred to us that we should have our own permanent cultural institution devoted to the preservation and perpetuation of Southern culture. And so that's what we're going to do in our new venue called South on Main, which is located right on Main Street in Little Rock, Arkansas.
Paint a picture of what will take place here at this one venue.
Well, when you come to South on Main, first of all, you'll be coming for a meal and for drinks, and it will be a reflection of the breadth of Southern culinary culture. So when you see that menu, you will be educated on Southern cuisine, and it won't just be fried chicken and barbecue. It'll be the low country cuisine of South Carolina, the cuisine of southwestern Virginia, and other places. So you'll really get a perspective on that. And then while you're enjoying that food and drink, we're going to be bringing cultural programming every evening that may be a literary reading, maybe a musical performance or a film screening or a dramatic reading or a chef demonstration, mm-hmm. but just something that brings to life what we've been delivering to you in the pages of our magazine. Again, that programming will run the gamut as well from very well-known names like Lucinda Williams and Iris DeMent to, you know, some of the students at the local universities or partnerships with Arkansas cultural organizations and festivals like our blues festivals and other venues. So people will also have a sense that there's a lot more going on in the South than they may otherwise understand.
Going on the horizon, you have laid plans for NPR broadcasts, and not only locally, but nationwide.
That's right. Well, we have an existing partnership with NPR. We do a series on Southern culture with them called Southward, where we actually do videos and they do radio presentations. Because they are so excited about our new venture here with South on Main, they're going to make it the second place from which they broadcast live content. So South on Main will be a venue for NPR to share what we're doing with the rest of the world. We're also working with Arkansas Public Television to develop a television show that would be on national PBS and be very similar to Austin City Limits, in that it'll be filmed in front of a live audience and again reflect the diversity of Southern culture that we've been talking about.
It's interesting how your vision of taking a print publication and keeping it viable differs from a lot of the models we see unfolding around the country. We're going to all electronic or whatever, and you're retaining that strong belief in the print medium, but yet multidisciplinary nonetheless, in a new way that you see, I know, as a vision of the future possibly for other magazines.
Now, I do think that what we're doing will be replicated. You know, to me, the print magazine is so important because our readers are readers. And so when they want that content, because it tends to be long-form content and because we put such a high premium on our layout, our art, photography, and that's all part of the experience of reading the Oxford American, some of that just doesn't translate to digital formats.
Part of a tactile experience?
I think it's tactile. I think it's the way people relate to the print and the way they can take it with them. Also, we're a quarterly magazine, so our content is not meant to be digested very rapidly. It's meant to be taken in over a 3-month period, basically. And so people can roll up that magazine, they could take it with them wherever they want to go, they can leave it on their nightstand or in their coffee table and work their way through it. And it's just something that you don't typically do on an electronic device. Now, saying that, I do make sure that our content is available via all of those other mediums. So we're on the Nook, we're on the Kindle, we're on every kind of digital format you can think of.
That's not primary. Right?
That's exactly right. Print will always be primary. And then this new venture, again, it's a content delivery system in and of itself. And it's real and it's authentic. And I think people are going to go out of their way to come to Little Rock, Arkansas, to taste that food, to hear those writers, to listen to that music. And I do think that, you know, magazines like Rolling Stone and The New Yorker, maybe others that we know of, will see the benefit in delivering their content in a similar way in the future. You know, the Oxford American will be the first print publication with its own venue, and, you know, it's something we're very proud of, and I think that it's something that is going to help sustain the magazine going forward. For further information about the Oxford American, you can visit our website at oxfordamerican.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Pleasure to meet you, and I'm so glad you could come to Little Rock.
Me too.
You've been listening to Warwick Sabin, the publisher of the Oxford American Literary Magazine in Little Rock, Arkansas.
This is Issues and Ideas on Public Radio KCBX. Support for KCBX is provided in part by Festival Mosaic, a celebration of 5 centuries of music throughout San Luis Obispo County, July 16th through the 28th. Tickets and a complete concert schedule are available at festivalmosaic.com. Coming up at 2 o'clock, it's On Being with Krista Tippett. Today's episode is The Last Quiet Places. Gordon Hempton is a recording expert who's traveled the world gathering the sounds of nature in areas free of human-made noise. Hear some of Gordon's stunning recordings from rainforest, prairies, and jungles as he explains to Krista Tippett why embracing the endangered experience of silence can lead to better relationships, a better understanding of ourselves, and a stronger awareness of our planet. That's On Being, coming up at 2 o'clock. But up next on Issues and Ideas, it's Ears on Art with Stephen DeLuque in conversation with Mark Beck, who has an exhibit at the San Luis Obispo Museum of Art. Ears on Art is sponsored by Marshall's Jewelers, creating and selling fine jewelry since 1889. You can visit them on the corner of Higuera and Garden Streets in downtown San Luis Obispo.
It is my aim to create beautiful paintings which transcend the superficial look of things to reveal meaning through enigma, allegory, and issues about which I care. Coming up next. Good afternoon. You have tuned into Ears on Art, a twice-monthly program focusing on the understanding and the enhancement of the visual arts. Ears on Art is produced in the studios of listener-supported KCBX Public Radio, serving the California Central Coast from Salinas to Ventura. Today's guest is former San Luis Obispo resident Mark Beck and his wife Carmela. I enticed Mark to do the interview by inviting him to dinner with mutual friends. Mark is one of the accomplished artists who not only produces works of tremendous beauty and technique, but also works that are thought-provoking and, at times, disturbing. After a few glasses of wine, we now join Mark, Carmela, and myself. Good afternoon. I am here with Carmela, Zoe, and Mark Beck. And I actually lured them to my house on false pretenses and the fact that I invited them out here for dinner so that I could get this interview with them. Good afternoon, Mark.
Good afternoon, Stephen. Thank you. Thank you for deceiving me.
So, Mark, the first thing that we have to discuss is, it's a question we ask all of the artists. When did you find the artistic bent? When did you think that you were going to be an artist?
Well, I was about 10, and there was a kid in my class that drew cartoons, and I just became suddenly fascinated with it. And I started just emulating him, copying him, and then I moved on, and by the time I was about 15, I was deeply interested in the Hudson River School painters. Mm-hmm. And I was oil painting by then. But for years I had been ink drawing, and I was really, really into it.
How did the Hudson River School influence you?
Basically, I just loved the depiction of these beautiful landscapes and the history behind it, that it was an offshoot of Manifest Destiny, the idea that this was our country and it was ours to conquer and explore. And that's kind of what they did. Some of them went even further than that. They went to South America, and this was a time before there was TV or even very good photographs. So it communicated to the outside world. And I found the whole thing very interesting. But mainly the paintings were just so beautiful. I was just so drawn to the beauty of the landscape paintings.
You used to live here in San Luis Obispo. What brought you here?
To San Luis Obispo? Well, I moved here in 1978 to go to Cal Poly and to study agriculture.
What?
Of all things. Yeah, well, being an artist back then wasn't really considered legitimate in most circles. I had a great high school teacher, and he had gone to the Oakland School of Art, but my parents asked him if there was any way he could talk me into becoming a lawyer or a doctor. So that's where that was. So I couldn't really imagine going down that road.
So I started at Cal Poly. I thought I would be a farmer and paint on the weekends, which, of course, is the last profession you picked to paint on the weekends. So after a few up and down years at Cal Poly, I was asked to pursue my educational goals elsewhere. And so I went to art school in Portland, Maine.
Why Portland, Maine?
The draw to Portland was that their mentor at the time was Cezanne. And I didn't really know that much about Cezanne. I learned quickly. But it was a very serious school, and they were very serious about drawing and color and design, and I lacked that. I was 28 by the time I went to art school, and I lacked basic formal skills. So I knew I needed to go, even though I had been painting a long time.
My initial training was in drawing, and I found that those people who did not have a basic in that were not very good painters. It's like, you know, you have to learn the basics of form and shape and shadow before you move on to color. Definitely. Did you find that to be true?
I definitely did. I didn't really even understand that a drawing wasn't just a floating image on a page, that it had to have a format, which is just a line that defines the space. That was a real eye-opener. And that also that colors interact and you invent them as you need them to affect you in whatever way you want. I didn't know anything about that. I just painted local color. Mm-hmm. You know, the sky's blue, the grass is green. So that was a big education. But yeah, and then I realized that drawing was definitely the foundation of it. And I think I had a pretty good inkling at the time. But it would be like trying to build a boat without knowing how to use wood tools. Drawing is definitely the basis for it.
You moved to the Central Coast, but your family was originally from New Mexico. And when you got here, you had some fairly interesting teaching experiences. Would you like to tell us about that?
At the men's colony?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I taught at the men's colony for 4 years, from 87, I think, to 91. And I taught evening classes of drawing for inmates, two inmates. And then they worked me into the Arts and Corrections program out of UCLA worked me into a position where I was a crew boss, and I hired inmates to paint murals for the community of San Luis Obispo. And so we made murals for Cal Poly offices. We put one in the DMV, offices like that. And it was a very intriguing job. And I was there for 4 years. And then I realized it was time to move on. And it was at that point that I was able to make my first really serious body of work. And the prison enabled me to do that because it paid really well. For the few hours I worked there, it paid well enough for me to pay rent and buy materials and get serious about painting, because I knew that I was going to go on to become a professional painter. I really had no idea what that really meant, but that's what I was going to do. So,
you have sold internationally, and specifically, I think you were some of your paintings were sold to corporate collections in Japan. Could you explain a little bit about that? Because that's something that I have absolutely no knowledge or experience.
Well, I had a show in Japan in a department store. And department stores there are very serious affairs. There was a couple that saw my work in L.A. or Pasadena or somewhere in Southern California, and they wanted to give me a show. They were art dealers themselves, and they lived part-time in California and part-time in Japan. So they gave me a show there, and it was very successful, and it really bumped up my career to have had an international show. As far as corporate collections, I'm not privy to all my collectors because usually it's not shared by art dealers, but I know that John Nordstrom has one, the owner of Nordstrom's. There's a son of the CEO of Exxon. And these were commissions, actually, mm-hmm. these pieces in the corporate type collections. And I'm really not sure about too many of the other collections, but that's definitely something that I've sought and try to encourage my dealers to place my work where it could be noticed by a lot of people publicly.
So you've mentioned commissions. How does that work?
Well, sometimes people see my work on my website or they see it in someone's home and they contact me and I talk to them and see if they know enough about artists and art to let me make the artistic decisions and work the way that I need to work. I've taken probably between 40 and 50 commissions over the years, and I've always had happy customers.
I have never liked commissions. I don't like others interfering in my artistic process. So what I've usually agreed to do is that I will do a painting as I want the painting to be done, and if they don't wish to purchase it, that's fine. There are no obligations. Do you work up some form of contractual relationship before you agree to do a commission?
Well, sometimes we do make a formal arrangement and they pay half down, but I don't make a painting that I wouldn't want to place in a gallery. So I don't, you know, if they want a picture of something that I wouldn't normally paint, I won't do it. I just won't take the commission. It really has to be a person that understands that they need to trust me to do what I want to do. And they're basically asking me to revisit a painting. And if I can see a way that means something to me to make another painting, then I'll do it. And sometimes they just give me too much of what they want, and I know that I'll never be able to please them, so I just don't do it. But, you know, usually before, I never have to say, sorry, I won't do it. They start getting nervous because they think that they don't have enough control, so they just gracefully back out. I enjoy it because just on a business standpoint, I know I'm going to get paid in the end. And I also get to revisit something that I came up with originally on my own. And it's usually interesting. And sometimes it even leads me to stick with that theme for a while.
We're talking about theme here because I tend to paint in series. And I know you have as well in the past. But is that something that is a mindset for you? Do you find something that's really obsessive and you maintain that for a while, or is it just a one-off and you tend to go different directions?
Well, lately, I think I do tend to go in different directions, but I think my style is finally fairly cohesive no matter what I'm painting. When I was younger, when I created my first body of work, I made simple buildings, and I just stuck to the theme because I knew I was going to market these things after the prison job was over. I stuck to this theme, and I set a goal of 16 paintings. And so I made those paintings. It was very cohesive. And now my paintings are as cohesive, but it's not the same subject matter. Different sized canvases, different topics altogether. But I think my color is consistent and the feeling and the handling of paint is consistent.
If you have just tuned in, you are listening to Ears on Art, a program produced in the studios of listener-supported KCBX Public Radio in San Luis Obispo, California. Today's guest is painter Mark Beck, a former resident of the San Luis Obispo area who now resides in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
We are sitting in my den, and I actually happen to have a Mark Beck painting hanging behind me, and it was part of his Shack series that he did. His new paintings are very bright, impressionistic. I'm astounded at the layers of paint on them. I mean, there's a history on each of the canvases. Is that something that you're investigating?
Yeah, I paint differently now. I used to paint very thinly and very deliberately. I usually did a pretty careful drawing and had a pretty careful idea. Now it's different in that I'm not afraid to change the painting completely. And sometimes if you introduce an element like a line or something and there's some texture to the paint, usually I would get rid of that somehow. I would sand it, I would scrape it, whatever. Now I just paint over it and I add more paint and I obscure it that way. And I think I just kind of layer it as I get more ideas and I spend more time on these paintings than I used to on single pieces. And sometimes I even glaze a little bit and then paint back over that and then glaze again. They're pretty thick now. The paintings are pretty thick. I do like paint. I like the physicality of paint. But I want it to read well from 6 or 8 feet away. And
the new work is much more impressionistic. Is that a product of age or experience?
Yeah, I think it's a product of experience a lot. Because I don't think that facility is really that important. Mm-hmm. I think if you like the way paint looks and you want it to look good up close, even if it is thick and globby in places, can still make it look good. I don't want it to look awkward, but it doesn't have to be really polished in order to work as a painting. It doesn't have to be super smooth. You don't have to brush every stroke out so it's completely flat. It comes with experience because you become more confident and you're not afraid to just go in there and make major changes if you need to.
I think every artist paints for communication. We tend to side on preciseness or realisticness. How much does that tie into what you're painting?
Well, that's a good question because I've struggled with the problem of realism for a long time. I think I still do because I tend to want to make things look right in a certain light. And then I find myself, I've just lost touch with my painting. Mm-hmm. So I try to figure out, how can I depict this thing so that it has the effect I want without killing it because it looks so real? And I don't want people to say, wow, it looks so real. To me, I failed.
We were joined by Mark's wife, Carmela, who is the business half of this married couple. Carmela and I have a bit of a history.
And we've been blessed because Mark's wife, Carmela, has entered the room. And Carmela was my very first employee. Back in 88, when I had William Stevens Dessert Company. And actually, she was kind of a backdoor introduction to Mark's work.
Yes, I first met Mark through a painting. My girlfriend and I were downtown San Luis Obispo at the Earthling Bookstore when that was there, and I saw his self-portrait on the wall. And I said, who's that guy? My girlfriend knew who he was, and she goes, oh, well, that's Mark Beck. He's an artist around town, and got to meet him. I looked for him and found him and finally started dating him, and that's about the time that I started working for you.
But that was when Mark was struggling.
Well, that dark horse that he painted, we were pals. I don't even think we were actually dating, but we were having coffee all the time together. I paid $500 for that painting, which was a lot of money back then. But it's because I liked him so much, and I love that painting. And he was poor. I mean, he was living in a barn and painting in a barn. But he was so committed and so talented. Yes. I think everybody wanted to support him because he was the guy that was always doing that, and that's all he did, and that's all he wanted to do, and he was really serious about it. And then when you come across in a small town someone who's that committed, everybody kind of notices that person.
What have we not covered that you want to be covered?
Well, I would say on the topic of Carmela that I wouldn't be the artist I am now without Carmela's support, both artistically, which I rely on, and business-wise. She does all my emailing. She is the office, and she suggests career ideas and dealers to contact who to send pictures to, and many things. And it's invaluable because I would just paint. Then, you know, everything else would fall by the wayside. I mean, there's very few artists that can do both. And if they can, they're really lucky. But I just recoil at the thought of sitting down at the computer to email people. I just figured out how to actually send an email a couple of years ago.
So, Stephen, when I think about someone like you, who's an accomplished artist, and my husband, Mark, the two of you are so gifted, but if you don't have someone who's out there in today's social media, I mean, there's people who post on Facebook 10 times a day, but that's kind of what it takes now to get your name out there and to get seen and to have people know that you're having a show. I mean, that's that's the way it is now. Like in the 80s, because I went to Cal Poly for journalism and PR, you know, I would type a press release on a typewriter, on an actual typewriter. And that's, you know, then you sent that to the newspaper and the newspaper would put a little posting. Yeah. But now it's all about social media and tweeting, and I haven't gone that far. But having an awesome website, having a great Facebook page. Do you have a Facebook page?
No.
Even that would be awesome for you. Yeah. Because you know what? People have contacted Mark from across the country from his Facebook page. Just Googled his name on Facebook and found him, and then you know, bought paintings from him that way. But you, I think you really need, as an artist, to focus on the artistic part, because that's what you do best. Because it is a huge time sucker and a time waster to get on the computer and do all that stuff. It takes like 20 hours a week of emailing and stuff. And that's, you know, I enjoy, actually, I kind of like doing it, I have to admit. But I also like connecting with people who love Mark and his work, and I help him with his business. But he's learning to do a lot of it. He does know how to email now, and he does know how to get on his Facebook page and do postings and stuff. But I think it's really helpful to have someone who does all that stuff, because it's not the artistic part. It's not the stuff that gives you ideas for your next body of work, or has you, you know, going to a graveyard in the middle of the day doing a charcoal and then deciding that you're going to do gouache and then changing it to pastel. And I mean, that's a whole different mindset.
I understand the importance of social media.
Yeah. But also because it's important that you know that people out there want to connect with you. That's the interesting thing, is that everybody in the world loves artists and they love music and they love good food. But how do they get that good food or buy that painting if they don't know who you are? So you need someone who's going to advertise who you are.
And I'm so not good at that.
Yeah.
And are you?
It takes a village.
No, I'm not very good at it. But I do, I realize in this world with so many artists and so few dealers, really.
Are there any?
Yeah. I haven't met any yet. I have had some good help with from art dealers. And I have long-standing relationships, which I appreciate. But you really need to, like Carmela says, you need to get your name out there as much as you possibly can, because it's incredibly competitive. And people that are really good with social media and promoting themselves all over town, everywhere they go, they get big opportunities. I just don't do it the way I should. You know, I'll put business cards in my pocket when I go out to an opening or something, and then I'll forget to even pass them out. Then I get home and empty them out of my coat pocket. Yeah. And I go, oh, damn.
Well, I think actually the whole marketing end of artwork is shifted. I mean, tremendously shifted in ways that at least a person of my age had never anticipated. It's like, you know, we used to go to galleries, we used to go to agents. That now is completely unimportant.
Yeah, you don't even need dealers anymore.
You don't need dealers.
No, there's a lot of online. There's even online selling.
Yeah.
A new thing that's happening in Southern California anyway is they'll have a show and then they'll produce a catalog for the show.
Yeah.
And they'll send it to the clients because it's a better representation than online.
Right.
And people will buy it right off the catalog. They may be familiar with the artist's work enough to know the surface and the general quality. They'll see the show online, and then they'll buy it off the catalog.
Right.
You know, it happens online. Actually, an online catalog. Yeah. So you actually turn the page. So it's very handy. And business gets done quickly that way, too. There's all this media stuff just makes things happen really fast.
It's not beyond my capabilities. It just takes a lot of investment, time and energy. And
well, think about how nice it was to all be at the opening on Friday night when we were there. Because we're all there together. And then when you go to a traditional opening, you get to meet the artist. You get to stand there with him near his painting and say, why did you paint that? Or what does that mean? And what did that mean to you? You can't do that in an online
venue. Or simply to be in the same room with the artist to me is important. Mm-hmm. I just don't understand this kind of off-person association.
That kind of thing makes artists feel more isolated than they could already be, because painting is solitary business. Yeah, so intensely personal, and it means a lot to get a little bit of feedback from real people. And if your work sells, that's great. But if you just meet that person for a minute, or they maybe even email you and say, hey, I have your painting, I love it. That can keep you going, you know, that could keep you going for 6 months. Like you said earlier, it is about communication and it's about making connections with the world out there. And that's a huge part of it. And if you sell a painting, then you have completed your goal. And that is to connect with somebody that feels the same way you do.
Thank you, Mark.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Stephen.
And thank you, Carmela.
Today's guests have been painter Mark Beck and his wife and business manager Carmela Beck. Mark currently has a show at the San Luis Obispo Museum of Art titled The Tyranny of Beauty. The show runs through August 18th, and the museum is located at 1010 Broad Street at the southern end of Mission Plaza in downtown San Luis Obispo. The hours of operation are 11 a.m. until 5 p.m. through Labor Day, and admission is free. The San Luis Obispo Museum of Art may be reached by calling 805-543-8562, and you can access more information at sloma.org. Mark has his own website at markbeckpaintings.com, where you can review his gallery of paintings and find out contact information. At the Steinberg Gallery at 1531 Monterey Street near California Boulevard in San Luis Obispo is a show of posters and installations titled Up in Arms, a Creative Response to Gun Violence. The show consists of 100 works of art by 45 different artists and runs through July 28th. The event is sponsored by the Peace Library, a community-based collaborative art project created by Julie Frankel and Melinda Forbes. Forbes stated, "The purpose of Up in Arms is to give people a voice and a venue to discuss gun violence." For information on the gallery, visit their website at steinberggallery.com. Gallery hours are 7 a.m. until 6 p.m. On a sad note, the radio community lost one of its own last month. Gary Squibbs, longtime actor in the San Luis Obispo broadcast scene, died of injuries sustained in an accident in June. Gary was a multi-talented individual, and his humor and his insightful intellect are sorely missed. Our hearts go out to his friends and his family. You have been listening to Ears on Art, a twice-monthly program airing the first and second Wednesday of each month at 1:30 p.m. Ears on Art is produced at the studios of listener-supported KCBX Public Radio, located at 4100 Vachel Lane, near the intersection of Los Osos Valley Road and South Higuera Street in San Luis Obispo, California. You can visit their website at kcbx.org, where you can review past programs of Ears on Art by clicking on the Archives button and selecting the program you wish to hear. The phone number for KCBX is 805-549-8855. KCBX serves Southern Monterey, San Luis Obispo, and Santa Barbara counties on the California Central Coast. We would again like to thank today's guests, painter Mark Beck and his wife and business manager, Carmela Beck. This is Stephen DeLuque, and for co-host and co-producer Krissa Hewitt, we thank you so very much for listening.
And that's Issues and Ideas for today. I'm Brian Lanzone. Up next, it's On Being with Krista Tippett. Support for KCBX comes from the Basin Street Regulars, presenting the High Sierra Jazz Band, direct from Three Rivers, California, along with the Basin Street Regulars, on July 28th at 11 o'clock. More information at pismojazz.com. Support is also provided in part by the Central Coast Wine Classic, featuring 50 California wineries, culinary samplings, and the music of Soul Sauce at the Reserve Winery Tasting on Sunday, July 14th at the Avila Beach Resort. Information at centralcoastwineclassic.org. This is KCBX, HD1 San Luis Obispo, KNBX HD1 San Ardo, and KSBX Santa Barbara. We are streaming live on the web at kcbx.org. Stay tuned next for On Being. The time is 2 o'clock.